Perfect. I appreciate that. All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Portland City Hall. This is the Portland City Council afternoon session of February 6th, 2019. Carla, I feel like we were just here.
Could you
call the roll and see if we've changed?
Sure. Fritz?
Here.
Fish? Hardesty?
Here.
Udaly?
Here.
Wheeler?
Here. First, I'm sorry. Nick Fish is present. Nick Fish is in the house. Good afternoon, legal counsel.
Welcome to the Portland City Council. The City Council represents all Portlanders and meets to do the city's business. The presiding officer preserves order and decorum during City Council meetings so everyone can feel welcome, comfortable, respected, and safe. To participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the council clerk's office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions or the first readings of ordinances. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. If it does not, you may be ruled out of order. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you are a lobbyist. If you are representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When you have 30 seconds left, a yellow light goes on. When your time is done, a red light goes on. If you are in the audience and would like to show your support for something that is said, please feel free to do a thumbs up. If you want to express that you do not support something, please feel free to do a thumbs down. Please remain seated in council chambers unless entering or exiting. If you are filming the proceedings, please do not use bright lights or disrupt the meeting. Disruptive conduct, such as shouting or interrupting testimony or council deliberations, will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being ejected for the remainder of the meeting. After being ejected, a person who fails to leave the meeting is subject to arrest for trespass. Thank you for helping your fellow Portlanders feel welcome, comfortable, respected, and safe.
Very good. Thank you very much. Carla, first up, items 109 and 110. Please read together.
109, transmit report to the City of Portland on Portland Police Bureau officer-involved shootings by the Office of Independent Review. And 110, amend contract with OIR Group for the review of closed officer-involved shootings and in-custody death investigations to extend term and increase maximum compensation allowed under contract by $60,000.
Very good. We'll start with Director Constantine Sevier. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, members of the City Council. My name is Constantine Sevier, Director of the Independent Police Review, a division of the City Auditor's Office, and I am here to introduce members of the OIR Group prior to their presentation to you on their latest report. The OIR Group members are Michael Giannacco, Julie Rulin, and Robert Miller. I won't belabor the introduction since they are not strangers to our city, and they have worked on police accountability issues in Portland since 2010. This report is their sixth report, and there was also a standalone report on the death of James Chassie that the OIR Group completed in 2010. Portland City Code requires that IPR hire outside experts to conduct reviews of officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths that are closed. The reports are required to be released on an annual basis. Over the course of their time at the city, OIR has eliminated a backlog of closed investigations that at one point stood at 20 cases, which interfered with the timeliness of the recommendations provided by these experts. Under their current contract, which only required them to review 11 cases, OIR has reviewed 15. Fundamentally, these reports that OIR has put out represent the city's values of that all life is cherished and that all officer-involved shootings in custody death represent a great tragedy that we as a government can learn from. In keeping with these values, The city has entrusted IPR with hiring national level experts such as OIR to conduct their closed investigation reviews and their reports that are submitted to City Council and to the public. Since the first outside reports were hired by the city that were conducted by the Police Assessment Resource Center, PARC, there have been 11 outside reports, 7 done by OIR, 4 by PARC. All said, there have been roughly around 300 recommendations. The early PARC reports really focused on providing the nuts and bolts of the current accountability system. First, that all officer-involved shooting and custody deaths should be subject to not only criminal investigations but administrative investigations. Back at the beginning of these reports, roughly a third of officer-involved shootings and custody deaths were not subject to an administrative investigation, which is the internal review that looks at whether the member's conduct was within the Portland Police Bureau's policies. Also, there was a need at the time, back in 2003, that all involved officers and relevant witness officers were interviewed, and that there needed to be better record keeping as to the course of the investigation and appropriate documentation as to what the Portland Police Bureau had done during these investigations. The recommendations by PARC and OIR have led to a significant amount of changes at the Portland Police Bureau. They've also led to more timely administrative investigations, the creation of the Police Review Board. They have also led to IPR serving as a monitor in officer-involved shooting cases and in custody deaths, the ability for IPR to review all officer-involved shootings and custody deaths, and our ability to approve the findings. These reports do not operate in a vacuum. They create opportunities for members of the public to leverage the facts gathered during these reviews and to also advocate for themselves, like several family members, I believe, will do later on today. One of the issues with the outside reviews has been that historically there was a focus on making sure that the Police Bureau was able to conduct adequate investigations of these officer-involved shootings and custody deaths. That really isn't an issue anymore. The issue, I think, with the most recent officer-involved shooting and custody deaths were, when we have learned lessons as a city, have we retained these hard-earned lessons? Is there a way for us as an organization, as a city, to learn from these incidents? And if we do make critical lessons learned from these, is there a way for us to retain those lessons? OIR has made a number of recommendations that the city has taken up and the Police Bureau has taken up. Another lesson that we've learned is that it is not solely the Portland Police Bureau's job to follow up on these recommendations. There have been recommendations to IPR. There have been recommendations to the Bureau of Emergency Communications. And there have been actions that, even if it is to a particular bureau, whether it is IPR or the auditor or the Police Bureau, it also would require council's action. And there have been a number of times over the course of these reports where council has stepped up, such as removing the 48-hour rule, such as the change in the Portland Police Bureau's deadly force investigations directive. Ultimately, when we look at these reviews and these outside reports, they represent a call to action for us as a government to live up to the best values of our community. And that is only our job. OIR's job is to provide us with the recommendation, and it is up to us to ultimately live up to our own expectations. Thank you.
Thank you. And are you going to introduce OIR?
Yes. Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
And Julie and Michael Giannacco and Mr. Miller are.
You guys can come up.
Great. And colleagues, it's my understanding that OIR, they'll introduce themselves, of course, they'll lay out their report, but it's my understanding you're encouraging questions as you go. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mayor.
Very good.
Mr. Mayor, Council, Portland Public, and other city family members that are in attendance today, we appreciate the opportunity to be with you this afternoon. My name is Michael Giannacco, and I'm a principal with OIR Group. Seated to my right is Julie Rulin, who is also a member of OIR Group, and my colleague to my left is Robert Miller. I'm going to be asking Julie and Rob to participate in the discussion, and as the mayor indicated, we have some remarks that we would like to make, but if those remarks are at any point, any of council has a question, we would appreciate that dialogue and encourage it. We have, as Mr. Sevier has indicated, we have been involved in reviewing critical incidents for the City of Portland involving its police bureau for the past 8 years, and our most recent report covers shootings that have occurred more recently, and the findings in that report are what I'd like to address. I'm not going to go over all 40 recommendations, but are prepared to answer any questions that council might have about any of them. But I am going to be talking a little bit about some of the what we find the key recommendations and sort of the common themes that exist in this report and may have been preceded by other observations from earlier reports as well. One of the things that, as Mr. Sevier indicated, I think one of the advantages of having a report like this is to, in fact, develop recommendations that the Bureau can, and Council and the City can look at, review, and to the degree they agree with the recommendations, endorse them and implement them. Another part of our report that we think has important value to the community is the transparency that the report itself offers to that community. This report talks about very critical and tragic incidents, and there is no other document, in my understanding, in the city that sort of tells the story about each of these incidents in an unvarnished way. Talks about decision-making of officers prior to the incident, evaluates the strength of the investigation that is then conducted, looks at the review of the investigation to see whether or not that was sufficiently robust, and then evaluates any after action coming out of the police bureau to see whether or not that after action addresses the issue in terms of accountability, supervision, equipment, remediation, training, and overall with the idea of better preparing police officers that work for the Portland Police Bureau for the future situation, with the idea that with all of these mechanisms and looking at the incident through all these prisms, that the Bureau will be better prepared and less likely to get involved in a deadly force incident on a forward-going basis. So with that, as I indicated, we intend to highlight three or four of our recommendations that appear in this report, but not get into all of them. I'm going to turn over at this point the discussion to Mr. Miller.
Thank you very much. We've chosen to highlight aspects of our analysis that are not only significant to specific cases that we review in this report, but also reach backwards, sometimes over several years, and come up frequently, either because they are tactically foreseeable issues that are major challenges to any police agency, or because they are issues that we have been talking about but remain unresolved. First one we call sergeants going tactical. Simply put, that means a field supervisor, usually a sergeant, becoming personally and often physically involved in the incident rather than maintaining her or his status as a supervisor, and perspective of the entire incident and ability to exercise his or her responsibilities as a supervisor as the incident unfolds. It does come up often. We see it at least once or twice in virtually every report we wrote, starting with report number one back in 2012. It sounds sometimes like an abstract issue of the way, you know, the internal management of field tactics, and it can be a bit of a sleeper because it sounds abstract. It's often not. And the case that most fully illustrates that is in this report is the Boucher case. Timothy Boucher was holed up in his residence, shooting off a high-powered rifle many times, and eventually that incident, and quite remarkably, was resolved without any serious injury to anyone. But in the meantime, a great deal happened, including the calling in of CERT, your special tactics team, PPB's special tactics, and a sergeant was leading a group of CERT officers behind, using an armored vehicle as it moved along as a moving shield. And at a certain point, that sergeant decided that he had to rectify something that he kind of on the spot perceived as a vulnerability in their cover. And he did so by exposing himself and made himself to be the first one to shoot directly at the suspect. He was partly overcome by gas because this prevented him from putting his gas mask on when the order to shoot gas canisters into the residence was given. And because he was overcome, he sort of lost the ability to perform his supervisorial duties, such as checking on his team and making sure they were in the proper situation. And he had to delegate that to the officer that happened to be standing closest to him. I think this shows that these kinds of guidelines have real impact. We recommended that the fact that sergeants should, unless they absolutely have to and there's no available officers to perform the duties, they should not go tactical and remain in their supervisorial capacity, that this should be emphasized and turned into policy. The second thing we recommended was that internal analysis by the Bureau review this issue every time it comes up and follow through on accountability when it's appropriate. So the good news is that the Bureau has considered for a while, since sometime after our initial and fairly elaborate recommendation about the topic in 2013, it has considered field supervision in its internal analyses, and we see that coming up often. The bad news, however, is that the Bureau did not recognize that as an issue in this case, despite what we view as a pretty dramatic example of the problem and a potentially very dangerous one. The better news, however, is that the Bureau is currently drafting a new policy directive to consider supervision and go steps beyond it to lay a foundation that could serve as a basis for making decisions about the adequacy of the supervision and possibly an accountability piece, if that's appropriate. We will, of course, keep our antenna up and report to you, this council, and to the Bureau if follow-through does not, in fact, appear to be happening as the Bureau has committed.
Thank you, Rob. Julie, would you like to comment on about a couple of our recommendations as well?
Yes.
And excuse me if you don't mind.
Commissioner Hardison.
Thank you. Before you move out of this particular case, one of the things that you mentioned in the report was that before all the officers had been interviewed, at the next day's roll call, there was a video that was shown of the incident. And so I'd like you to talk a bit about why that's inappropriate the next day to be showing that video, and then what are you recommending about that?
The video that had been taken by air support of the incident was shown by way of a training experience at roll call. Removed from the circumstances, we think that's an excellent way to use real-life videos and other ways of expressing events that have happened that everybody can relate to, that take place in territory that the Bureau members are familiar with. It can be a very powerful way of training. However, in this context, the Bureau has policies and procedures in place whereby the involved officers are not supposed to discuss the matter with one another until they're interviewed, or see videos until they're interviewed. And inadvertently, we're informed this violation of that, it's certainly the spirit of that policy occurred, and you know there were it really messed up the normal protocol, which is a good one. Our recommendation is don't do that. And that's what we put in the report. Just make sure that everybody understands that even an air surveillance video really shouldn't be, it should be seen eventually if it's useful for training purposes, but not the next morning.
Right. So I just want to be clear that the public understands. So there were officers who had not been interviewed prior to them seeing it at roll call. Right. And so, and you're recommending that if a video is going to be used for a training purpose, it will not be shown to officers who have not been interviewed, who've either been a witness or involved in the shooting itself.
That's exactly it, Commissioner Hardesty.
Okay. Moving on to another couple of recommendations that we make in this report. In four of the nine shootings that we evaluate here, the subjects demonstrated an intent to engage with police officers with the apparent goal of causing the end of their own lives. In our 2016 report, seven of the 11 cases we reported on there showed a similar sort of pattern. And in those cases, back in the 2016 report, we saw the frequent use of a term that's popular in general lexicon. We saw it used by the police bureau, and that is suicide by cop. It's not a phrase that we like because it tends to suggest that the outcome was inevitable, that the police bureau had no way of avoiding that outcome, and we recommended in 2016 that the Bureau eliminate the use of that term and eliminate that sort of language. And so we were pleased to see and grateful that the Bureau was attentive to that, because in the four cases that we evaluated for this report, we did not see that phrase used by the Bureau in any of its analyses of those incidents. Nonetheless, in one case, we did see in the training analysis, and that was the case involving Mr. Perkins, the training review said that Mr. Perkins' suicidal mindset left the officers with no other options than to fire. And again, here we have expanded the recommendation that we made back in 2016 to say to include that sort of fatalistic language, and that we suggest that the Bureau abandon that kind of fatalistic language, because it does suggest that the officers had no other alternatives. In other cases, we've seen similar kind of language, that the outcome was driven by the subject's actions. And it's our belief that skillfully trained and well-equipped officers have the ability to influence, often have the ability to influence the outcomes of these cases, and have some role in not just responding to the subject's actions, not just because somebody desires the police to shoot them doesn't mean that the police have to oblige. We have found that the Bureau...
Excuse me. The framing that you're making on this is an assumption that you're buying into the police assumption that somehow this person wants the police to shoot them. And so just the way you're just presenting it just makes it sound like, you know, the person was expecting that they were going to get shot by the police. And I think unless we know what the person's mental health state was, if we know all the factors that were involved, we cannot assume that the person woke up that morning and decided, I think I'll get shot by a cop.
You're right, Commissioner. I think that when we're there's no way to know exactly what was going on inside a person's mind. What I'm talking about is sort of the objective facts that the officers see when they arrive on the scene. In some of these cases, we've seen subjects who are saying things like, come and get me, just shoot me. So there is some objective evidence that the people are expressing that this...
But we don't know whether they are expressing that because of a mental health crisis that they're in. So, again, I just think that you're making an assumption about the person's motive as compared to just giving the facts. This is what was said. This is what they did. And so I'm not picking on you, but I just feel like for the public record, it's really important that we're not buying into anybody's narrative of what happened or didn't happen. I'm just really interested in what the facts were.
Right. And I'm talking a little bit with some generalization, so we're not talking about specific facts of all 11 cases, so we're not effort to sort of group them together and talk about the theme. And the theme is really to your point, and that is the danger in using that sort of language that suggests there was no alternative. The danger of that is that we see a less rigorous analysis. It lets officers off the hook, if you will. It lets the Bureau off the hook in terms of having to really take a look at what could we have done differently, what were the alternative courses of action that might have led to a different outcome. On this point, in one of the cases we reviewed here, and that was the case involving Michael Johnson, the Bureau did a rigorous analysis of different tactical alternatives. We generally were complimentary in our report of the analysis that the Bureau did. And unfortunately, the medical examiner in that case found in his report and testified before the grand jury that the manner of death in that case was suicide. He did so based on the evidence he saw. There were suicide notes in Mr. Johnson's pockets at the time of the shooting. He had written some notes on his arms, on his body, indicating an intent to end his life. He had some hesitation marks on his arms. And the coroner, the medical examiner in that case, used that evidence to find that the manner of death was suicide. We were troubled by that for a couple of reasons. First, you know, as we've said about the rigor of the analysis and what that could lead to. But beyond that, there's some very real grand jury implications. The district attorney in that case still took the matter to the grand jury. It's questionable whether, with that finding from the medical examiner, if a grand jury had decided to find an officer criminally, potentially criminally liable, whether that could have held. In other jurisdictions throughout the country, we've seen where a coroner rules an officer-involved shooting to be a suicide. We've seen district attorneys say, great, you know, we don't have to do anything further with this case because it wasn't, there could be no criminal liability for the officers. So we actually had a conversation with the medical examiner in this case. He seemed open to having a dialogue about this practice. He seemed to understand the point to be made about the implications of such a finding. And we encourage the Bureau to engage in that dialogue with the ME's office and see if we can get to some understanding that would eliminate those findings in the future. The Bureau, again, in our conversations with the Bureau, seems to get this issue, but also there's a concern about the district attorney's involvement and the fact that the district attorney is running the criminal investigation and is the entity to interface with the ME's office on these issues. And so,
If I may interrupt you for just a second, we had this conversation in my office yesterday, and I really appreciate the details that you provided. And I just want to make sure that we get those on the record here. The last time I heard of the ME putting suicide when clearly there are bullet holes in someone who is deceased was in the case of Chris Kalonji. So explain how the DA gets involved in the medical examiner's determination. How does that happen when I thought that they were separate entities and actually should not be communicating at all?
Well, I think the Bureau's point to when we discussed this issue was that the district attorney is, as the person who's ultimately in charge of the criminal investigation of the shooting, is the person to be interfacing with the medical examiner's office. The ME is the DA's witness at the grand jury, and so the Bureau's point was that they would like to involve the district attorney in any of those discussions.
I just want to say I'm troubled that the DA is trying to influence the medical examiner before a true bill has been issued or before any additional public information is known. And so I'm not quite sure what we do as a city council. Do you have any recommendations on how we should respond to that?
Well, I do think that as city leadership, that council could either back or support or be involved in a discussion with all of the criminal justice partners that this impacts, right? The Bureau is the investigative agency. The medical examiner has a role and responsibility about cause and manner of death. The DA is supposed to present this case and does present this case to citizens in the grand jury. Our point is that we don't think it's right, and we don't even think it's factually based for the medical examiner to make this decision. So I think if the family, the criminal justice family, got together and hashed this out and explained to the medical examiner the implications of this finding and how it could undo or upset the natural flow of investigative and prosecutive information, that would be helpful. And we think that you all as city leadership should maybe ask for a report back at some point to see how that discussion went. That would be my suggestion. I wanted to end our part of the presentation by just talking about two concepts in one that emanate from our discussion, from our report. And that has to do with the concept of action-reaction and as it applies to, in particular, the killing of Quantes Hayes, as well as how the Bureau analyzed that concept. Action-reaction essentially is a principle of physics that the Bureau regularly trains on. And what it really does is instruct its officers that you are not going to outdraw an individual you're confronting who may be armed. And so since you can't pull out your weapon or train your weapon or shoot your weapon after the shots are coming your way, you're going to need to anticipate that and perhaps even take action when you see a threat begin to come, the hand into the pocket, a reach out from the pocket, potentially producing a weapon. And if you wait for that gun to be fired, that's going to be too late for your safety. And the Bureau also trains that the implications of that principle are that you have to the degree you can, when you can, respond in a way where you remain in a safe position so that if, in fact, you make that observation or the individual you are encountering conducts themselves in that way, you will find yourself behind cover in a safe place some distance away. Distance always provides more safety for the officer. And therefore, that action will be seen by you objectively as less of a risk to you, and you can maybe allow that action to go forward a little more before you feel the need to take action, meaning the use of deadly force, instead of putting yourself in the open, putting yourself too close, putting yourself in a position where, because you are exposed, you feel the need to take action when any kind of suggestive movement is made by the individual you are trying to detain.
So I found this part of the report, and we had a chance to discuss this a little bit. I found this to really be the meat of the report. I found this the most important part of it personally, because the anecdote, if you will, for action, reaction in your mind was time and space. Could you talk a little bit more about that and what your
right.
findings are and what your recommendations were?
Yes, Mayor, and time and space is exactly it. In addressing a situation, provided you have both the ability to have the time and you have space or can create space, and I would add cover to that as well, and the ability to get behind an object so that the bullets will not hurt you if they come your way, all three of those aspects, if you have that, and in Hayes, they had that, then you should take advantage of those abilities and positioning in a way where you're in a safer place. The other thing that's important, Mayor, is if there's a supervisor on scene, and in this case there was a supervisor on scene, that supervisor should ensure that the other officers are responding to this incident, take advantage of time and space. And in this case, while they train that way, we are not convinced, because the Bureau didn't go through these mental gymnastics that I'm suggesting they ought to have, we are not convinced that the analysis sufficiently explored those other options. There are other issues as well coming out of that case, arguably conflicting instructions. That's another thing that a supervisor ought to be doing, is to, you are the one, not the supervisor, but this officer is going to be the one that's going to be instructing the individual as to what we want the individual to do. In this case, the individual was in an alcove. He wasn't going anywhere, right? And obviously, the next thing for the Bureau to do is to bring him out from that hidden place and then safely bring him into custody. That mission failed. That's not what happened. But other... by using these other techniques and recognizing the principle, it could have happened. And so that's the kind of analysis that we would have liked to have seen. We didn't see. The review board, there's no documentation in the review board, which is a board consisting of police bureau leadership as well as community members. There's no documentation that the principles that the mayor and I are talking about were also discussed or analyzed or documented or reviewed, and there was no action plan coming out of any of that analysis if, in fact, it did happen.
So let me ask you a question. I'm going to give you a very imprecise and maybe completely inappropriate analogy. Air traffic control. So an air traffic controller sits on the ground in a room with a screen, and they might be watching any number of aircraft. They're not in the aircraft flying an aircraft while trying to manage the space between the other aircraft, right? They're on the ground, and they have sort of the holistic, the big picture approach.
Right.
And given sort of my meager knowledge of air traffic control principles, they have protocols for all of the operations of those aircraft. They have a checklist, if you will. that has everything to do with keeping separation of those aircraft. Mm-hmm. Getting back to the policing question, is it your contention then that the supervisor on the scene basically plays that role of air traffic controller, if you will, that they're looking top down at the whole scenario and they have some checklist? Do you have time? Do you have space? Do you have cover? And that should be a constant set of considerations that's being reviewed proactively at the scene. Is that what you're contending, or are you contending something different about training? Give me a role of what you think that supervisor should be doing on scene. Obviously, you think they should not be actively participating in the tactical operation, and that seems self-evident.
Correct. And your analogy holds to some degree. They're not going to have time to get a clipboard and do a checklist and get a sign-off by a supervisor. That's not going to happen.
But communications,
but
right?
The idea, the mental checklist, the going through, do we have... You know, a sergeant gets on scene. Are the other officers positioned appropriately considering the situation? What's the dynamic here? Who am I going to get to give instructions to the individual as to what we want them to do? And how are we going to do it? And to the degree that it's possible, in this case it looked like it was possible, are there other things we need to do? Do we need to get a car here so that we have more cover? Because it was kind of an open area where the officers responded to. And then, you know, how are we going to, can we wait? Can we even bring a crisis negotiator out? I mean, there are a lot of things that supervisor ought to be thinking about as they go through. It's kind of like another analogy we talked about this morning. It's kind of like calling a timeout so we can come up with a better plan.
Okay. And we also had, you know, we looked at the flip side of it this morning, and I think I said maybe, and I didn't mean it in a disparaging way, I was just calling it the way I saw it, we're Monday morning quarterbacking. We have the benefit of time, we have the benefit of the reports, we have the benefit of reviewing and looking at best practices. We weren't there at that particular moment. But the way you were describing this makes a lot of sense to me. And I guess my next question is on the flip side of this. Are we putting too much expectation on that supervisor, or do we believe that is a realistic scenario where the supervisor comes in and maybe, you know, doesn't have a 10-point checklist, but maybe has a 3-point checklist, cover, safety, distance, you know, whatever it is, whatever
right.
It turns out to be?
Every case turns on its facts, and a lot of it will depend on whether there is time, what the configuration is. Every case will be different. But the point really is, from the advantage of hindsight, and I embrace the concept of Monday morning quarterbacking. I think that's what every good organization, entity, team, et cetera, does, is Monday morning quarterback, through the prisms of accountability, getting better, remediation, instruction, debriefing, supervision training, so that the next time the department, the bureau, is better prepared to address similar challenges. And that's the only way that the bureau can improve. It's to learn from these tragedies instead of just let them move on. And police culture, being what it is, tends to be a move-on kind of culture, because they've got a challenge tomorrow and the next day and the next day. But the idea of taking the time to review with consequences sometimes. When Monday morning quarterbacking, there are consequences sometimes. Some people get cut from the team, right? And so all of those remedial options should be available to the Bureau as they go through these cases.
Correct, Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A few more questions. When we spoke, you talked about some of the challenges with the Police Review Board. Mm-hmm. Would you be kind enough to share what we talked about yesterday as regard to the Police Review Board?
Yes. The Review Board, when it was constituted, was cutting edge. I mean, it's a rare, and it still is rare, where most police agencies, when they have a shooting, it's paper review. A report is prepared by their investigative agency. It goes to the DA. And if the DA says it's fine, it's fine. That's standard. And unfortunately, in many police agencies, that's still the case. In the Bureau, and for some years now, they have had a system where at least the Bureau, command staff, training, IA, the investigators, And, remarkable and sort of unique to Portland, two community members are part of this discussion, right? So on principle, that sounds great. The issue that we have been having as a result of this is that we think that the Portland community needs to move to grad school. And by that I mean we think that that configuration can and should produce a wider array of results. Right now, the kind of drilling down is primarily to the trigger pull. The decision to use deadly force, there is some findings about whether or not emergency medical aid was provided in a sufficient and timely way, but that's kind of it. And so much more could come out of that exhaust pipe of that review process, and in our view and in our recommendation should, Commissioner.
Thank you. We talked about when witnesses are interviewed, normally they are videotaped. Yet when we interview police officers to get their story on the record, we only do a verbal recording rather than the videotape recording, which makes it a little challenging to actually be able to see the gestures and movements that they're making. Would you like to comment on that?
Yes, and I'm surprised we haven't gotten to where we have in police science and police interviewing techniques. But particularly because what an officer is often describing are dynamic movements, observations of individuals, and he's asked or she's asked to describe positioning that occurred at the time. And as you can see, what I'm doing many times in response, an officer will be gesturing, will be demonstrating, will show how she or he was holding the firearm or drawing the firearm, all those things. If they fell, if they had a hand-to-hand issue involving the individual they're trying to detain, all of that is described. And oftentimes we'll say, and it was like this. And then we're reviewing the audio tape. What is this? Because we don't have a video or depiction of what's going on. So our recommendation is let's move away from that. I think that the Bureau has the capacity to do this because they do videotape many witnesses, defendants, and in other instances. And so we recommend that that same approach be employed for officers involved in shootings.
Excellent. One last question, having to do with your recommendation that the Bureau of Emergency Communication be involved with the debriefing. Could you talk a bit about that?
Sure. We have, over the course of our time reviewing these cases, sometimes come upon issues with the dispatch. And by issues, I just mean there are questions that come up in the investigation about whether or not things were effectively communicated to the officers. Was the right information passed on? A host of issues, and the Bureau of Emergency Communications has come up in a few of our recommendations over the years. And one consistent thing we have said, well, two really consistent things, has been when those issues arise, we think it would be a good thing to invite Bureau of Emergency Communications personnel to come to the Police Review Board so that those questions can be asked and answered in that forum in the spirit of kind of getting to the bottom of the entirety of the issue. And then the other thing that comes up is the question about the frequency and availability of cross-training experiences. The police officers and dispatchers are communicating with each other all the time, and for critical incidents and responding to people in crisis, there's great value in hashing some issues out in the training environment and letting Bureau trainers and BOEC, you know, trainers and personnel come together in that kind of environment.
So, Mayor, I look forward to working with you to try to figure out how we make that happen.
I would be very open to that conversation. We had a conversation with the chief this morning. It is not a simple thing to do, but it is certainly doable. And it would be at the will of this council. And it may involve some bargaining issues, and it may involve some aspects of the DOJ settlement agreement. But this is one of those issues where the ball's in our court.
That is what we had proposed as far as the initial discussion and dialogue, and we're obviously here to answer any other questions.
I have a couple of more questions, and then Commissioner Fritz, I believe, has at least one question. You're in sort of a unique situation here in that you are providing reports to a relatively new mayor and a police chief who is not present for really any of the issues that you're reporting on. Nonetheless, as the police commissioner, it is very important to me, and I'm sure it is equally important to my colleagues, that the work prescribed in this report be respected. And so I'm curious to know what the reaction of the Portland Police Bureau was to your findings. And we'll, of course, have the opportunity to ask the chief as well.
Yes. Per our protocols, when we prepare our report in draft form, we send it to IPR, we send it to the Bureau, not with the idea of changing any of our findings or recommendations. It's for two purposes. One, to fact check, make sure we have the facts right. And sometimes there are documents that we don't have that do alter things, not usually. But also to get the sense for how does this going, will this work, what do you think, sort of get a preliminary read on how doable the recommendations that we made are. And we've been through a few leaders of your bureau because we've been around a bit. And I can say that particularly this last discussion, what we were impressed with was it was clear to us that every one of the participants on that phone conversation had engaged and read and thought about how do we develop an action plan in response to this report. That, I think, was different than other discussions in the past. The second thing, and maybe the more important thing, is that by the time we had that discussion, protocols were already being written. There had already been a commitment in their in-service, which is coming up next month, to do a lot of the training, and they've actually found a way to insert it into the training. I think that most of the in-service training in March will be OIR-derived, which is fine with us because we think it's important to do it. And so that would be, proof is in the pudding. It's not there yet, Mayor, but I think that those are very optimistic signs that that the chief listens and gets it, and to the degree that she has authority, and she has a lot of authority to move this organization, intends to.
Thank you. Commissioner Fritz, and then Commissioner Hardesty.
I noticed the chief is in here listening intently. Thank you. You mentioned that your recommendations go to the Independent Police Review, they go to the Bureau of Emissions Communications, as well as to the Police Bureau. Commissioner Hardesty asked last week, you know, how many of your recommendations have been done. Do you have a tally of how many have been done?
You know, my understanding is that Commissioner Udaly.
Close enough.
Udaly.
Yes.
I know how to say it. I just didn't say it. Commissioner Udaly asked as a homework assignment of IPR to do that, and we did look briefly this morning through the compilation, the table that was prepared, and it appears that the acceptance rates in the 90% range, you know, to the degree that there's true implementation, Commissioner, that remains to be seen.
Well, that's it, because it's accept, accept, accept. Does that mean done, done, done? And so I hope that next time we'll get a list of what actually has been done, because I was struck that this report over and over again remarked on the 48-hour rule going away and how that needs to be implemented consistently.
Right. And you're absolutely right. And sometimes it's impossible to know whether or not the recommendation is going to be implemented because the situation hasn't presented itself yet. You know what I'm saying? So, for example, we made some recommendations on this pit maneuver that stops high-speed chases. And as far as we know, there's not been a shooting connected to a pit maneuver since. So sometimes we're not able to give a definitive answer until the incident happens.
And that might be a good thing. Thank you.
I think it is a good thing.
Commissioner, I'd be happy to share this with you. I want to thank Director Sevier for putting this together for me. Now I know what the expression on his face was at the meeting last week. There are 191 recommendations since 2010. There are only three items that the Bureau is in disagreement on. There are many that are in practice or being attempted, but I have to say that the significant majority are simply have been agreed upon, but perhaps not implemented.
Yeah, that's, I think that's what I'd like to know, because...
Well,
so there's one other column I'd also like to add to that, and that is, whose responsibility is it to implement the finding? And we had a little bit of a conversation about this on a separate... Well, no, it was related to this, actually. It was the first reading of the ordinance last week. You know, we have a responsibility as well. We have a role, and some of this can be changed by administrative fiat, by the chief. Some of it we have to chime in, and we have to provide the support. Other pieces still have to be bargained collectively. So there, it's a little more complex than just saying the Bureau did or the Bureau did not. And I think it would be helpful for us as a council to have that checklist, and as OIR or any successor organizations come forward, we have that ability to actually say what was the response and what was actually done and who is to be held accountable for that action.
If I might amend that just slightly.
Yeah, absolutely.
The six elected...
I'm sorry, yes, of course, the auditor.
Yes.
Absolutely, six. And Director Sevier, of course, works for the auditor.
I would say the other challenge is...
Thank you.
We've had four police chiefs in the 9 years that we've been doing... We've been working with OIR. And just because something was implemented doesn't mean it stays implemented. There are several recommendations that you're making now that you've made over and over and over again, and every police chief has accepted it and implemented it. However, the outcomes have not stayed, right? And so I would love to have recommendations from Michael and the team about how do we make sure that the reforms that we are paying to achieve, we actually are able to maintain? And I'll give an example just for folks who weren't in our room when we were having this conversation yesterday. We talked about the 21-foot rule, where that used to be a common practice of Portland police officers to say, well, they had to shoot because somebody can, within 21 feet, stab you before you can pull your gun, point it, and actually shoot it. We've dispelled that myth to most Portland police officers. However, there was an officer interviewed as part of this report who actually alluded to the 21-foot rule. And so so I'm curious as to how do we ensure, as the people who the buck stops with, that once a police chief has accepted those recommendations, that they stay accepted?
Well,
easy questions. Right?
No, not really. but let me take a stab at it. I really do think that, one, you know, there's this principle, and I used to work for the federal government, so I can say this, but there's this principle with USDOJ sort of that departments or bureaus, agencies, policing can be fixed. Like, you can come in, do your work, monitor it for a few years, and then go away. And that, to me, just doesn't work. It's the police agency, police bureau, is a living, breathing agency. Today's challenges will not be tomorrow's challenges. Leadership changes. Policies remain on the books, but then they're not enforced. So I do think that one way to do it is to, because you all don't have the access to the information to know what's going on in the way that we would as auditors or anyone else would with this assignment, you need to continue, I think you need to continue that work in some regards so you have somebody looking at the raw information, but then to be engaged and either... If things go off the rails and somebody isn't interviewed, there's a substandard investigation, there's something going on where the 21-foot rule continues to be a vestige within the Bureau, somehow that needs to be addressed, either individually or systemically. And somebody needs to continue to engage leadership of the Bureau to make sure that happens.
I'm sorry, may I have one more?
Yeah, please go ahead.
The report, your latest report, shows that
a couple of people were shot and killed as an officer was falling. And so it begs the question, at least in my mind, as a non-weapons individual, that if the officer had not been falling, would that loss of life have had happened? And so one is whether, can you tell from your investigation whether or not we are training Portland police officers in...